Welcome to the On Course podcast presented by the New England Golf Journal. I am Sean Melia. I have to my right, as always, Jim McCabe. Jim, how are you?
Very, very well.
All right.
Two verys.
We're creeping up on master season. I just wanted to get some early thoughts. We're recording this, what is today, March 14th, March 15th, mm-hmm. But the episode will probably come out closer to the Masters. Might be the last time I get to talk to you before the Masters, because you get to go down to the Masters and you do your road trip, which we talked about around this time last year when we launched this podcast. Right. But just early thoughts, any things that are mulling over in your mind as the Masters approaches? It's Players Championship week this week. So, you know, some believe that that's the first major of the year, and some believe the Masters is.
It's funny how fickle we are, how quick we are. It's a knee-jerk world to the 10th degree. Scottie Scheffler, 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, he'll never win again. He can't putt. And now he may never lose again.
And he grew a beard and got a mallet putter.
And he got a mallet putter, and oh my God, I'm sick of stories. It's easiest. It's a low-hanging fruit story of all time.
Yeah.
Changing putter. They always change putters. Like, yeah, okay. Yeah, going in, I mean, clearly, I do think it's the world of pro golf right now. It truly is the world of pro golf right now. I think all week leading into the Masters and at the Masters will be, what are the live guys going to shoot?
Yep.
I remember last year at the Masters and John Rahm won, but I mean, the buzz was, Phil Mickelson and Brooks Koepka and live guys. And I mean, you got to be naive to think that these guys signed big money deals, they go to play live. It's not good golf. I'm sorry, it's not a good platform. A lot of money, but it's not a great platform. But you got to be crazy to think that they can't still play.
Sure.
Well, last year was kind of the first year that there was that sentiment. Let's see what they can do. Well, Koepka nearly won the Masters, did win the PGA. So all year, I think that is going to be still a story.
Of course.
What are the live guys going to do? There were way few of them. I forget what the number was. I think last year there were like
18, I think.
16, 17, 18 live. This year, that's in half.
Yep. Because the world rankings have just
crushed them. Have crushed guys. I think that's going to be a story. I think can Scheffler continue this beautiful stretch of play? I mean, his ball strike in the last 2 years has been, I mean,
insane.
I mean, it does. There are a lot of things that are over the years that have been compared to Tiger Woods. It used to be shameful for people to say, oh my God, this guy's won more majors at age, oh, he's won more PGA Tour tournaments at age 25 than Tiger. Almost no one ever compared to Tiger since then. What Scheffler's doing is kind of Tiger-like as far as his ball strike. And, I mean, he is just automatic. And we'll see if he can play. I am intrigued to see how Rory continues to handle the mystery that Augusta is to him.
Yeah.
While continuing to be, I joked about it earlier, but, I mean, it's almost like, I think there's too much over. We're getting overwhelmed with Rory. Rory, every time Rory talks, it's a story.
I know.
I want to see how he can ease into Augusta. And there are some guys that are interested to see who can play Augusta, because Augusta is not a golf course for everybody.
Right.
And I'm talking about the younger guys who can come along and play like Jordan Spieth came along and got the plays down pat. Justin Thomas
has not
figured out Augusta.
Yep.
And so there are some good stories.
Ludvig is another interesting one, just as far as and Hovland. We're gonna let's Scandinavian Victor, stories, but Victor those Hovland. Like those two, as far as one who's played Augusta a few times and had a good finish last year. It's amazing that we are in a world right now. We have two golfers who are under the age of 34 who are one major away from the career Grand Slam, and like it doesn't really move anybody's needle as far as stories. Like Rory's story isn't about the career Grand Slam as much as just can he win the Masters, right? If he had if he had two majors and no Masters, and he had the Butler cab or the incident on 10 where he hit it 75 miles left and made a double and all that stuff, that would still be a story. But the fact that he every year shows up and could win the career Grand Slam, and then the other interesting story that used to be a thing that we would always talk about in the 2000s and even maybe 10 years ago is the best player to never won a major. Those conversations don't happen anymore. I mean,
not really.
It's very interesting that two very interesting stories that have historical significance just don't register anymore because we're so worried about some guys from a breakaway tour.
Yeah. Yeah. The live thing is, I don't know. I don't have a dog in the fight anymore, but I almost want some sort of peace because I'm just frankly tired of listen to it. I respect the elite players who are on Live. I don't respect the platform they play and the format they play. It's good for them.
Yep.
It's not fun.
Yep.
And I do not think it's a real true test. But yeah, I just find it, we're coming up to, we're 10 years since Rory won
a
major. It's hard to believe.
I know.
And you keep saying, this time. Well,
yeah. And 7 years since Spieth won a major. And Spieth. It's incredible.
Cantlay still hasn't won.
Shoffley.
But,
right? I mean, there's all these guys who haven't won yet. Last year you picked Spieth. Spieth did not win. Early pick. Who do you like this year for the Masters?
I would have said Hovland. I love Hovland's game. I love his composure. And then he's been flat the last couple of weeks. But I like him to win? Maybe not. I'll stay. I like him.
I do too.
I think he finds his way along. So I think he's going to surprise because I think a lot of people have kind of already tossed him to the side.
Yeah. All right. So Victor Hovland's your guy to watch.
Yes.
Maybe a top five. If you're a betting person, you can dabble in a top five, top three.
That's my story. I'm sticking with it.
I think Scheffler's going to win. I think we're in this. Remember Arnold Palmer won. I was looking at old stuff last week. He won every other Masters. Right from 58 to 64,
60, 62, 64, and then never won another major.
And then never won. He won seven majors in 6 years. It's an amazing, a little bit like Rory with fewer, but
right.
And they never won again. And he was a spokesperson for the game. Like Rory and Arnie and Phil Mickelson have some interesting comparisons you could make. But I think Scheffler could be he wins in 22. I could see him winning three green jackets in the next 6 years. And having three total.
People forget last year because, John Rahm did win the Masters last year, and John Rahm battled Brooks Koepka. Scheffler was nowhere to be, really was never not right in the thick of things. And I think people were really, I think the media was overplaying or hitting the panic button with Scheffler a little bit. Oh, my God, he can't putt. It just reminded me of being out when I was covering golf all the time in those years when I used to listen to people tell me all the time, Vijay Singh can't putt.
Yeah.
Dude, the guy won 40-something times.
Yeah, nine in a year.
He overtook Tiger Woods when Tiger Woods was Tiger Woods.
Yeah.
Vijay Singh. If Vijay Singh made every 15-footer that people think he should have, the guy would have, his scoring average would have been 56.
Right.
Vijay Singh putted okay.
Yeah.
I mean, when you have such a high-quality ball-striking game as Vijay did and as Scottie Scheffler right now has, the microscope is enormously unfair to you. And I mean, TV does a lovely job, but they also distort the picture. They show these, look at this pick. It's a 2 foot, 2.5 foot, 3 foot putt, but it's got 7 inches of break.
Yeah.
Oh, he missed another short one.
Yep.
I think we overreact. Scotty Scheffler is such a ball striking machine. Yeah, I think he's gonna be right there.
Yeah, I think so too. I think he might
still
win.
Going with Victor
Hovland. Yeah, yeah. I think just Scheffler might be the every other year guy for a few here. So yeah, so well, looking forward to the Masters as usual. I've got my hat on, I'm getting excited for it. Let's bring in an amateur legend in Massachusetts.
Yes, he was.
In another gym, in Jim Salinetti, who's the Winchester Head Pro. He just won 2023 New England Golf Professional of the Year as well. So he's a great guy, great golfer, doing some great things at Winchester, yes, bringing some junior golfers along. So let's bring in Jim Salinetti. I want to welcome in Jim Salinetti to the podcast. Jim, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Stoked you're kind of at the beginning of the busy time as a head pro. I'm sure it's never not busy, but March, getting ready at Winchester. What's that like right now, just to ease into the conversation?
Yeah, sure. So my people are definitely chomping to play golf. So our lesson book is very full. We were lucky to have a really good indoor facility here at the club. So all of us are teaching a ton, and all the new clubs just arrived. So we're fitting, doing a lot of fittings, and people are ready to play golf. A lot of questions. When's the course open? When's the learning center open? So we got to play defense for a little while to make sure the course is ready to go, but we're getting there.
Golfers don't like that.
Yeah,
let's play. I just had that conversation with Sean. I said, I do love to play, but I don't like to get out on my little golf course until the ground's ready.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, as an person who played phenomenal amateur golf, and as a podcast and a publication that focuses a lot on college golf, high school golf, I thought we could start there in your kind of golf life. Been doing a little bit of reflecting on even my own college golf career, and which was terrible, but you know, have text chains with those guys still, high school buddies, and just I'd love to start at URI and that experience playing and the friendships that you have with those guys. The talent that was on that team is pretty staggering as well. So that's where I wanted to start, just URI, Jim Salinetti, early 2000s, and talk about that experience as a college golfer and kind of how that shaped you.
Sure. Well, Jim McCabe, he summed it up pretty well and is a great article you wrote last year, which was very flattering, and all of us really appreciate what you did there, Jim. That was really special to summarize at least part of our career in that way. So it was really cool. Yeah, I mean, it was obviously a lot of best decision you ever made, where you pick your college, because that's where your life, sort of your adult life, begins, right? So I chose it was the only school that was north of Virginia that I even was even looking at. We were all thinking, go south and play a little bit more golf, make the season longer. A lot of the better programs are down there. So, but I chose to stay closer to home. The program was really growing at the time. Tom Drennan was putting it together via the Adams Cup, which was a tournament for Country Club. And that really was what got the program going, is having a tournament before Country Club and playing one of the top programs gave us the chance to have an incredible schedule. We flew to just about every tournament we played in, and then the ones we played in New England kicked some butt in. So it was great. I think from an athlete standpoint, you want to pick up whatever sport you're picking. You want to choose a school, a program that you're going to improve, you're going to go to, you're going to get better. And I definitely got a lot better there. That showed in some of the things I did on the summer months after I turned pro. So I feel like I got a lot better there from an athletic standpoint. So it worked well for me there.
Jim, as someone who didn't play college golf, I've always been fascinated.
I barely play. Let's be honest here.
When you're on a college golf team, what is practice like? And especially those days must have been a blast, considering the friendships you had with everybody, the level of talent, Sims, Justin, Josh. What was practice like? Was it very competitive?
Yeah.
Were you helping each other? Or were you trying to beat each other even in practice?
Sure. Well, I have a few stories for that. So practice at URI is a little different than you go to University of Tennessee, where they have their own golf course and they have amazing practice facilities and Alvin simulators and indoor facilities. So like, that wasn't what URI was like. I knew that going in. We knew we had to make our practice worthwhile. We had to get creative. So I'll give a couple stories. Right, my freshman year, Bryce Waller, he was a junior when he was a freshman. And Bryce is the head coach at the University of Central Florida now. Better coaches in the country, you know, I think, well-respected college coaches in the country. So he was on our team. And on the freshman, we had the fall season. Obviously, fall is fine because it was pretty good. We're busy playing tournaments anyway. And then, you know, it'd be November and weather's starting to turn in Rhode Island. And I was getting a little complacent already, and some of the guys weren't practicing after class because they didn't need to. The season was over. And Bryce pulled me aside. I don't remember exactly what he said, but he's like, you have to pick your own plan on any whatever team you're on. Like, if the little guys aren't practicing, it doesn't mean you can't go down and get some balls in the field. We have this field that we get balls down right on campus or outside of dorm, like, just shag your own balls, which is what I was used to when I was a kid anyway. So, and it was like eye-opening. I didn't know, I was 18. I was sort of following the crowd a little bit, following the older guys. And he goes, you want to get better, you got to do it on your own. So I learned that quick. I think about that all the time in my life. I tell our junior golfers that all the time. I've told that story a few times. And so Bryce, he had a big impact on me just that freshman year. And it's funny that he's a coach and he's probably telling his own kids that every day as well. And then after practicing, I was a little play at Point Judah. Practice at that point, which was right down the road. And once we moved off campus, we lived right down the road. In Narragansett from Point Judah. So it was great. They were really good to us. I do have another funny story about practicing. So you mentioned Josh Hillman. He had a good friend, great representative of the program. He was eligible his first year, so he wasn't traveling with us. And we get home from a tournament, and Coach Strang gets a call from the pro, by Judith, and called Josh. And Josh was my roommate at the time, and she had a good call. Pro called Coach Strang and said, "Hey, one of your guys, he was on the back of the range for 2 hours. He had 3 buckets, full buckets of balls. And that we don't mind you guys out there, but sometimes it was a busy day. Like, there's just too much. There's the same balls too long." So Josh actually got suspended from using the back of the range for shooting. That's like this over's use of the range. So again, I don't think that's happening at the University of Florida, right? So it was a little different back then, and I'm sure it's a lot different now as well. But we had to make our own practice time. We tried. It was great as a team, though. Like, when we were out there playing, we were, to answer your question, we wanted to kick each other's butt. That's for sure. Qualifiers were intense. Not even if we were disqualifying for a spot, just because we wanted to be a low qualifier. And then we had a lot of fun matches. The cool thing about Rhode Island, obviously it's not the best weather, but Port Judith was always open. They put two cups in every green and put little pins to everyone. So like, you could go out there in January and play on a nice day. We did that all the time. They were nice enough to let us do that. So
nice. No, I mean, I always felt the key to your team, Mike Sims was different. He came from, but you had a group of kids that really knew what New England weather was like and what the region was like. And Justin was Justin from Philadelphia area. Sorry, that's still at least regional. And that had to have played advantageously to your team, did it?
Was great. So when the few tournaments we played in New England, anyone played college golf in the Northeast knows that rain pants is probably the most important part of your uniform. So when you get your rain pants at the beginning of the year, you're going to wear those more than anything. So not necessarily because it's raining, but just because it's an extra layer for us. So we were great in the Northeast. The tournaments we play, the handful of the year we play, and we had a streak going for a while. We just went. But then we travel so much, and we go to better climates. Then we were just excited to be there. So we'd spend more time on the range than anyone because we were just excited to be in 70-degree weather and so 40-degree weather practicing in February and March. So like So when we traveled, we did well, did just as well, because we were excited to be there, different competition. So I think, yeah, it was 2017. It was a little soft at the beginning, that's for sure. I mean, obviously, it's, there's the no Michael Semsey's from Bermuda, with high school in Florida. So he had, when he, I don't know how we got him to come up to Rhode Island. So he was a little soft from a weather standpoint at the beginning, but he learned quick. He was good. He was just as good as anyone once we got going. And certainly when it was windy, he had no problem. But he learned to play in layers.
You do.
You're a Western Mass kid, just growing up out there, learning to play golf. How did you get into the game? Who were the people who brought you into it? And then we can love to hear about you won 3 Mass Ams in 4 years. As I kind of looked through your resume, there was a little bit of like, we got Ryan Downs right now, who's another Western Mass kid who's kind of winning everything. And as I was looking through, I was like, oh, this is like Jim Salinetti was the first Ryan Downs. I'd love to hear about growing up in Western Mass, learning the game, how you learned it, how you got into it, and that piece of your life.
Yeah, sure. So played a lot of sports growing up, played basketball, soccer, and my sisters, they're 10 and 8 years older than me. So I really grew up watching them compete and everything. They played Division III college basketball and soccer, but my youth, I remember going to every NESCAC and small college gym in New England, because that's all I did. When my parents and I would just be driving from exit 2 on the bike to wherever gym they were playing, and I'm driving the inland. So we did a lot of that. So I think that's probably where I got my competitive juice. I just watched so much, watched my sisters play college sports and in high school. So I just wanted to play anything, and I played a lot of basketball as a kid, and I continued doing that. But golf was where I could tell I was going to that's my sport. And I really started taking that more seriously late elementary school, junior high. And I was lucky. I tell even our kids here, like, your situation, your success all depends on the situation you're in. And I was really lucky to join Stockbridge Golf when I was like 10 years old. And it was just really junior golf, family friendly. I could play golf with my dad on Saturday morning at 8 o'clock. That doesn't matter around here in Boston, as a 12-year-old kid. So I could play. The club was welcoming to us. A friend of mine, Trent and I, we would just play golf. We played 27, 36 holes a day, every day, all day. And I mean, how could you not get better? I had some good role models out there to teach me. Jim Walker, Tom Sullivan, I know we've talked about a lot in this podcast. I had a good situation going, where I just had every opportunity to get back. And it wasn't anything crazy. That sounded like we got shipped off to a golf academy and going all these high level camps or anything. I just played and practiced. I got some good lessons locally, and then played some tournaments. And then going into US amateur golf, and it was a lot different back then. You didn't play in the state am until maybe your senior in high school, usually like more in college, right? We're talking late 90s. Now 13-year-olds are qualifying for the state am and doing well. Bench play, it's amazing. And I got Ryan Downs winning them when he's sophomore. I almost won that year. So he's young. They're all young. And so I didn't play in my first state am until in between my senior year in high school and freshman year in college, stripped down and tried to qualify. So, and then just started to have success right after my freshman year in college. Most events, nothing crazy special, just worked hard. We practiced and played as many tournaments as I can, and things went my way.
Yeah. Did you ever feel, it's not a national tournament, but even on the Massachusetts scene, that you kind of, the newspapers know who the Kenny Lewis and Mike Carboni and Brent Warner, they knew that. Did you ever feel you were a kid from Western Mass and no one really knows me? Even though there were really good courses out there, and tremendous courses out there, there wasn't a statewide spotlight on all. Did you ever feel, coming from Little Lee, Massachusetts, no one's even going to know who I am?
That We play our junior golf in Albany. We are in the Northeast New York PGA section. So I played with state junior every year. So go on. We go out east a little bit here and there. But besides the state junior, we would play most of our junior golf in New York. It's great. Border summer. So no, I didn't know a lot of people. Driscoll was the guy back then. He was a great, he's about the same age as me, but he was a grade older than me. And then we ended up doing a PG year. So we ended up being in college at the same time. Same grade in college. So he was the guy. I mean, he was absolutely a junior golfer. He was sort of one of the first ones that started to play. The bigger amateur ones when he's a little younger, but so many kids are going now. So he was the one that we were all trying to beat. And but no, when I started playing more on the amateur circuit at college, I didn't know a lot of people. I just kind of had a longer drive than everyone else, and that was about it. I had to stay in a few more hotels than some of the people that live down here now and locked in the area. So it was just fun. It was just fun to compete. And we're so lucky in New England to have a good little circuit to play on in Judea.
Is there, just as you watch, Winchester has some good junior players, some kids who are playing in college, just comparing like their competitive environment to 20 years ago, 25 years ago when you were playing, is there anything that you look and think like, man, this is way better, or this is something that I'm glad I didn't have to maybe manage or deal with, that these kids are kind of having to manage and deal with in their time playing?
I mean, it's hard. But my kids are getting older and worried about how it's going to be. Like, I mean, social media is so different now. Like, it probably puts a little more pressure on them. You know, probably puts more pressure. We went out to a tournament. I was hoping Jim McCabe would write an article about me if I did well. But now you have a good front line at a tournament, and Mass Golf is tweeting about it and putting it on their Instagram. I kind of think of that as like a cultural talk about, you're worried about your own game. Now you're worried about what's going to be on social media before you're around finishes. So I think that's, I don't know if people think that way, but I sort of that way a little bit. And I'm just a fan now for the most part of these kids. So I'm watching. I don't mind the constant updates because we're teaching them. So I want to see how they're doing. So I like it. And I like being able to go on websites and see their whole lives. We didn't have any of that. So it was, when I was in college, my parents just anxiously waited at the phone for a short phone call on the kitchen to see how well would the team shot that day. How did you guys do? That was the first thing we all do. We'd get our hotel rooms and dial up our parents' numbers and say, oh, I shot 72 today. The team shot 295. It was like, so that was it. It was so, what a different world the kids live in nowadays. Then from like an instructional standpoint, I mean, it's all about track man numbers now. Certainly didn't have that. I barely have video back then. You know, definitely saw our video a little bit. I mean, now the kids, they're on, they see stuff, they feel something in their swing. They have their buddy tape it on their iPhone. They look at their swing. Oh, there you go. This is my position. And then they'll help their trackman. Some of these kids, our kids have our trackman here. But, you know, some of them, junior golfers and college golfers have their own trackman. Like, they all know their numbers. That's for darn sure. They're all bragging about, I got up to 120 today. That's what they're trying to do. And so it's a totally different game. I agree with that. I think it's fine to know your track numbers and try to get your ball speed up and try to, I'm all in for that. But, you know, as long as they know how to score and understanding, that's the most important part is what they're shooting, how they're doing the events. But totally different ball than it is. Totally different.
Yeah. The point. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, too, I wonder sometimes, I just get a little nervous when people that I don't even play as well as I do, and I'm not very good, will often go, oh my God, they shot 75. Oh, they shot 77. I don't want people to lose the perspective of the big picture here. The game is still difficult. And I think sometimes it's easy to sit back and whether it's you're looking at pro scores or good amateur scores, or I get nervous sometimes that people can sit back and go, oh my God, how'd they shoot 77? It happens. And I want people to keep that perspective of the game. It's not, I always tell people it's not an easy game. It's a difficult game, but it's an easy game to love. But it's not an easy game to score at.
Yeah, no, it definitely isn't. And when I see some of these scores, like, it's definitely a lot lower than when I was flying my day. But I agree. You never know. When you talk about juniors, you talk about younger amateur golfers, you just don't know, like, they have a lot of other things going on. They might have just broken up with their girlfriend. They might have had trouble out of text. I mean, I was just talking to a college coach before, you know, this morning before I got on. He's talking about his first tournament of the year, and he's like this player, he had a bad first round, and he goes, yeah, like, it was a nightmare. We had our flight was canceled the day before, and had trouble to get down there. We didn't get trashed around, like, things like that happen. And that's the thing, you don't know, like, you don't know that. You just pull up golf stat on the computer and shot 78 that day, what the heck. So there's a lot of things that happen in this game, and you can, that's why I just think it is tough on some of these kids with instant gratification with all the information out there.
Yeah. Live scoring is one of the, you went the extra step of, like, you can't even shoot a good front nine without the world knowing it, or suddenly someone kind of shows up with a camera and has you on video because they want to see what you do for your second nine. Yeah, it's the live scoring thing is great because you can follow along, but in the back of minds, it's got to be like, oh man, someone's watching me trickle down the leaderboard, or they're scanning the bottom third and I know that's where I'm going to be. I'm like, what are people going to think? It's really hard, even as someone who just plays qualifiers around here, like, that is sometimes in the back of your mind when you're over 4 foot putt, which is maybe something about my mental state, but it is a completely different dynamic for a lot of these kids. Do you think they're better at handling it because it's been part of their kind of golf routine, that it maybe doesn't stand out as much?
I'm sure it is. I haven't had that conversation with you. I don't really want to have that. I don't want to like the big worry about that, to be honest. So I haven't really had that conversation, but heck, these kids, I mean, my kids are young. They're so used to us just taking pictures of them, you know, playing any sport at the recreational center where parents are always snapping iPhones on. So they're used to it. They're probably everyone knowing what's going on. So as they grow up, it'll be the norm. I look back and I don't think I'd mind. I wouldn't mind it. I would sound straight. It's just a different, just something we don't have to worry about, I guess.
Everyone has their own paparazzi now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, everyone's got, whether it's the parents or just somebody, someone's always snapping. You are exactly. People always watching you, McCabe, on the golf course.
No.
No one's creeping around.
My friends don't even like to watch. We don't like to watch each other play. It's just like, talk about you're a tremendous amateur player. You turn pro. Different world all of a sudden. What was that like to be out there where, I mean, I know a lot of professional golfers, and I know for a fact they really don't care who you are. Talk about that transition, and then after doing it for those years, when you said, okay, I'm going to do something else.
Well, I mean, I loved it. When I turned pro, like, I was so excited. I was really lucky to have some backers, so I didn't have to worry about things financially too much. I was careful to market the game to go play, but I certainly didn't, at the beginning, I didn't have to, I wasn't working another job, and I was just able to really, when I was up here, when I was in New England, I could really focus on the game, like, when I go south, I had a place to play. Just, I had everything that I needed to succeed, and it started out pretty well, and I had some good success, and just like anyone, you start to, when you get when I'm not that I changed my swing much, but I started to work on my swing, and I wasn't improving quite like I wanted to. I was still shooting pretty good scores, but I wasn't anywhere good enough. You go into those two slumps here and there, and it was just hard to get out. And yeah, it just had a bunch of up and down years, and nothing wrong. I was still working hard. I was doing all the right things, I think. And I think I just got to a point where I didn't think I got hurt a little. I hurt my back, and I had to take some time off. First time I really had to take any time off from any sport. I was in my late 20s. And so I just I went to PAT after I got healthy again. I passed PAT. And I was like, I'm not getting into the, PGA of America. And I did. I liked doing that. It was something different. I figured, hey, if I want to still compete, I'll still be able to compete club level. And I just wanted to see where I'd go from there. I didn't want to get out of golf just in case I ever wanted to, in case a game really came back. I said, I'll get back into it. So I wanted to stay in golf, and I knew nothing. And that's all I knew. I made so many good connections, from my playing days and from all my travels, that I just knew that they'd be somewhere. Whatever side of the golf or business I chose, get that. And that was true. That probably was the case, and why I ended up where I have some success down the road. It's probably from my playing days, from my good background.
That's good. You are there moments when you are at one of the premier golf clubs in New England and probably the country. Are there times when you're late in the afternoon, you're closing down the shop, you look out and you have a great bunch of junior kids playing, and you put a smile on your face and know, man, I was that kid that you're looking out at?
Yeah, I guess so. I never really thought of it that way. So, my favorite part of the facility is our learning center, it's not that new anymore. It's about 8 years old. We have, so if you haven't been there, it's a great range and a nice teaching building. And we have a short game area, but then we have a short course called Week Course, which is 6-hole par 3 course. So like, that's my favorite spot, because to your question, late in the evenings, you go out there and some days it's just 5 or 6 juniors hitting balls. Someone's in one of the teaching bays getting a lesson. And then a lot of the younger ones and the older ones are out at the Week Course. So just having fun and having a game or having close to end contest. So like, that's what I love to see. And we do have a pretty big membership. So there are a lot of juniors of all ages. I mean, we have Division I golfers to just kids that are just wanting to learn from playing, just have fun with their buddies. So those are my favorite times of the day to see the learning center packed with kids, and we're lucky to have it. They're lucky to be here. And we also have an awesome staff that really just that encourage them to be out there, help some of their golf games. That's the environment we're trying to make here.
Awesome. Golf is an amazing babysitter.
Hey, you're right.
Just listening to you talk about your growing up, and there's so many people who tell those same stories, and I always think about golf was a babysitter for so many people. You get dropped off, go play your 27 holes, or go play the Wii course, and go hit balls. I mean, that was my childhood too. And I remember a little 9-hole course, and I played that place a million times, and with my buddies or not. And it was my babysitter. And I think that's it's kind of an apt way to think about how so many people grew up as kids playing the sport more than maybe any other sport. So it's a great image to think about, for sure. And then kind of just thinking about you've been at Winchester now for 14 years, right?
This is my 14th year.
14th year. All right. So over that time, I know you have had kind of your mentors growing up, and then once you became a pro, like what are some things over the next 10 years you hope for Winchester, for junior golf, it's kind of at an inflection point a little bit with the sport we've talked about a little bit, but just it's kind of not a great question, but just thinking about your future at Winchester or in the game and junior golf, where do you see it heading?
Yeah, that is a good question. Now, demographics change like clubs a lot, whether it has to do with wait lists and membership to type. So from a junior golf standpoint, our numbers are changing a little bit just because the memberships changing. But with the cool thing we've had at Winchester is then you just never know where you're going to find a good junior golf. The cheap golfer doesn't have to start at age 6 and just gradually work his way up and play in any PGA tournaments and Challenge Cup and then maybe some national events. Like, it doesn't always have to work like that. I mean, we've had some of our best junior golfers they were great athletes in other sports, decided to stop playing hockey or baseball picked up a golf club. They had played before, I'm not saying they're brand new, but they started to take seriously. And then they're good athletes. They're great competitors. I've seen play Division I college golf. We've had a few of those. So like, I get excited. I'd always tell someone to say, no, we don't have the high school team's going to be good for a while. I'm like, just give it a chance. Someone's going to stop playing hockey. Someone's going to stop playing the sport. And he's going to play golf. We're going to be just fine. Like, we're going to be great. And there's going to be junior golfers all. So I remind people that. And that's the cool thing about golf is, like you mean, people don't pick up a club until they're older and then becomes their absolute passion. That's what happens to kids. They get just as obsessed with like a little college ball on the golf club as they do with a basketball when they're younger. So that's what I get excited for. You never know where your next junior golfer is going to come. You might be down with a tool when they're 10 and you can't get them off the learning center when they're 16. So it's really neat that way. So it's like the unexpected. So I guess when I think of the 10 years, I don't know who our stars are going to be, but I think they're going to be out there. We're going to be having fun way or the other. Try to give them some good instruction and some good memories.
Yeah, and you've got the high school team that plays there too, right, on a regular basis. Yeah. So you get to see some of those kids too, for sure. Jim, any last thoughts?
No, I just know that most people know Jimmy would say, man, they're lucky to have him. But I know Jimmy feels he's lucky to have Winchester too. I mean, it's a great team. Great team there. And always one of my favorites.
Yep.
Always a pleasure, Jim.
Well, thank you guys. I appreciate the kind words and thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for joining us and enjoy this march towards the season.
You got it. Thanks. Thank you.
Yeah, Jim.
All right, we have another Golf Course Confidential little segment at the end of every podcast. We pick out a place, or I pick out a place, and then we chat about it for a little bit. Sometimes it's a place you've never played. Sometimes it's a place you have played. I thought because it's March and everyone's mind is, I know I've got one golf trip planned for May, and I'm already trying to figure out my dance card for places I want to go play this year and little trips I want to make throughout Massachusetts to see some new golf courses and play some new places. I wanted to do the next two episodes, at the very least, a little bucket list edition. So we're going to go a little bit higher end, but still public places people can go play. And this week, in honor of Jim Salinetti's former URI teammate, Josh Hillman, we've talked about Taconic before. Mm-hmm. And sweet. I want to talk about Taconic just as far as a place that, if you're thinking about splurging a little bit, making a bit of a trip on a weekend, or even just during the week, you can get out there in a day trip. Sure. Taconic in Williamstown. It is Williams College's home course. Josh Hillman is the head pro and the men's golf head coach there. It is, at least as of last year's pricing, I think it was $200 to play 18 holes. But if you know an alum, you get a little bit of a discount each time. I think it's $100. It's $100 if you play unaccompanied. So if you have a student or an alum or a faculty member who can just get you a tee time and you can go play by yourself, but they're your unaccompanied host, it's $100. If you play with a member or any of those people I just mentioned and they're playing with you, it's $60. I played it for $60 last year with a member. It is awesome. It's hosting the Mass Women's AM this year in August. So if you want to see it in like prime shape, maybe go in the end of July, beginning of August, make a trip out to Williamstown. I know that it's your neck of the woods. You went to college out.
Okay.
It is one of my favorite places that I've played in the last 4 years when I've been trying to play every course in the state, and I'd never played there before until 2020. Awesome. And it just blew my mind. What do you think about Taconic? We've talked about it on the double dip.
I've told people before, I think the statute of limitations are over. I've been out of college that many years. Because I never knew it cost any money to play Taconic because we used to take a day off in the middle of the week because that you can do that in college.
Yeah. You know?
And we
not anymore though. College kids who are listening to this, you can't do it anymore. You could back
we,
in the day.
We'd take a day off and we'd treat ourselves. We'd play Wabika was our go-to place. Wabika Springs. But then we'd come on, let's go play Taconic, and we would drive and park our car in a strategic place, take our clubs, throw them over the fence, climb over the fence, and play the same six holes all the time. So I never knew how you got from 1 to 18 there, but I knew this. It was sweet, and that was back in the 70s. It's only better and better and better.
Yeah.
Bottom line is if Taconic, unfortunately we're a parochial or provincial world here in eastern Massachusetts, but if we were ever inside of 128, it would be, if not the best course in the state, it'd be top three.
Yes.
And it is that good. It's even better
now.
I know, since Gil Hans's work. It is. And you talk about people going out there. I would highly recommend doing it. If you are the type that likes to do these things, add Wabika to it. And you can play some beautiful golf, of course, and Crump and Fox on the way home.
Yep.
But Taconic is worth
it. Is dynamite. It's great. We have a whole podcast. People can, if you're listening to this piece, Jim and I last year did a 36 Holes in a Day podcast where we just each came with a list of here are two great courses that you could play in a single day in New England, and we jumped around and gave a bunch of different ones, and Taconic and Wabika was one of them.
Yes.
And so I cannot recommend highly enough. It might be one of my favorite back nines, like set of nine holes. I've been thinking a lot about that. Just what are the best nine hole back front, back or front that I've played? It is, the back nine at Taconic is so good. It is so hard. It's so hard, especially if you want to play from the tips, like the closing stretch of holes, 15 and 16 as par fours are just monsters. Is it the 12th that you hit over kind of a huge, almost Barranca ridge? Tee shot goes up over it, and then 13. It's just a really excellent back nine.
Yes,
it is. One of my favorites. So, Taconic, if you're looking for a new place to play and you're looking to splurge a little bit and you've got like the Golf Jones in you right now because it's sunny out and golf is so close and you want to make a trip with some friends, Taconic is one that I recommend for everybody. Go to Williamstown, play it, stay in town for the night. Heck, play it twice, but go check it out. Go play Wabika when you're out there. Crump and Fox on the way home isn't bad either. If you live kind of in that part of the state, or you drive through Deerfield, right? Kind of that area, Northampton.
You can get on that
right
way.
Bernardstown.
Two.
Yeah. So those are three options, but Taconic is a must this summer. Go play it. Splurge a little bit. Treat yourself. That's it for today's podcast. Thanks to Jim Salinetti for joining. Jim, thanks for being here. Please rate, review, subscribe to the podcast. We are on YouTube. We are on Spotify. We are on Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen. Thanks to Dave Yaz for producing the podcast. The OnCast podcast is a Siemens Media production.